Hello, podcast listeners. Austin Film Festival would like to let all of you know that badges are now on sale for the 20th annual Austin Film Festival. That's right, to experience OnStory and get a first-hand look at the creative process from today's leading writers and directors, join us, the 20th annual Austin Film Festival. Get your badge at www.austinfilmfestival.com. That's days of films, parties, amazing panel discussions with some of the most creative minds in the industry. That's austinfilmfestival.com. Get your badge today. And as always, we'd like to encourage all of our listeners to go to the podcast page in the iTunes store, search Austin Film Festival's OnStory podcast, and rate and review this program so that we can continue to bring you episodes of the show. On to the podcast. Today, on Austin Film Festival's OnStory podcast, it's a disaster. With the film's writer-director, Todd Berger.
As I learned from the DVD commentary of Kevin Costner's The Postman, when you put yourself in front of the camera, then it's just like another thing you gotta worry about, and I didn't feel like worrying about it.
The stars of the movie, Julia Stiles.
Everyone was there because we liked the script, and that just changes the whole vibe on set.
Jeff Grace.
The independent film market is so bad right now that it is weirdly like, I think we can make more money off a play than that movie is going to make.
And Kevin Brennan.
Yeah, don't be shy about sending it out there to their people.
The Vacationeers, who gained notoriety through their series of viral comedy shorts and their first independently produced film, The Scenesters, are back with this year's art house black comedy, It's a Disaster. This low-budget hit employs a single location and an ensemble cast to depict four couples who've gathered together for Sunday brunch when they realize that several dirty bombs have been set off nearby. The film also stars David Cross, America Ferrara, Rachel Boston, Aaron Hayes, and Blaze Miller. Today's podcast was recorded at the 19th Annual Austin Film Festival on October 21st, 2013. We begin with writer-director Todd Berger, talking about the origin of The Vacationeers and the inception of It's a Disaster.
So we started doing live improv shows, mostly as an excuse just to do funny web videos. And then eventually I wrote a script for the four of us to do under the Vacationeers kind of productions banner, which is their LLC. It was called The Scenesters, and it played here at the Austin Film Festival in 2009, I believe.
That's correct, yeah.
Yes. Available on iTunes and Amazon and Netflix.
Full price purchasable Amazon DVDs. Don't buy the used.
And we kept continuing to make funny videos. We came here with some of our shorts and some of our web videos. And eventually we met Julia through a friend of a friend, and we were just hanging out one night, and she had seen some of our videos, I think through a friend's recommendation, and she'd seen our movie, The Scenesters, and she said, hey, we should do a funny video together. So we went and shot a video. It was called Julia Stiles. It's about her creating a fake eco-friendly fashion line, but it's all like clothing made out of newspaper, and it was pretty funny. It made the National Enquirer. Yeah. Because they said you had a beef with Julia Roberts.
Yeah.
She was not happy about you mocking eco-friendly items.
Oh, no.
There was it was some clever turn of phrase on the Mona Lisa smile thing.
Yeah,
like,
it was Mona Lisa frowns.
Good one.
So we had done this viral video with her, and it got some attention. And then when I wrote this script for It's a Disaster, we were originally planning on just shooting it like in my house on the weekends, because it's all one location, as you'll see. There's only 10 characters in the whole movie. And so I gave it to these guys and said, hey, we're bored, let's go shoot another movie. And they said, why don't we send it to Julia and see if she wants to be in it? And we did, and she did. And then once we got her involved, we were able to get the rest of the cast involved. That's when we went to the amazing Aaron Hayes. So we just gave the script to people. People signed on, and then we went and shot the movie in last September, in the hottest 3 weeks of the year in Los Angeles, all in one house. That's why we're here. The origin story kind of behind the idea was I was reading an article about the 1960s zombie movie Night of the Living Dead, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the George Romero movie. And the article was about how it's public domain because they forgot to renew the copyright in the 1970s because someone was like, no one's ever going to care about this movie. So you can do whatever you want with it. So actually, if you're a filmmaker and if you ever want a movie playing in the background for free, Night of the Living Dead. And so I thought it would be really funny because I really liked the movie Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid when I was younger, the Steve Martin movie where they take a bunch of film noirs and they edit him into it. So I thought it would be funny to shoot a bunch of new footage of a couple's gathering for board game night in the 1960s, and then there's a zombie invasion, but make it a comedy. So basically just use a bunch of footage from Night of the Living Dead, shoot a bunch of new footage. So then I watched Night of the Living Dead, and I was like, this is hard. So I didn't do that. But I really like the idea at this point of a bunch of people getting together for just like a game night, you know, neurotic Woody Allen-esque type couples, and then something horrible happens outside, forcing them to stay inside and deal with it. When I was writing the script, I was trying to differentiate the characters. First, I knew I wanted four couples at four different stages of relationships. So like one's been married a while, one's kind of this hip bohemian weird couple, one's like just on their third date, one's like the long engaged, but they haven't set a date yet. But I wanted to differentiate the eight characters from each other, so I based each one of them on one of the stages of grief, kind of hope, acceptance, denial. So when this disaster does happen, they each approach it differently. And, you know, when I met with each one of them, I told them kind of that's where I was coming from with the character, but they can talk more about how they...
Yeah, then later I would... you told me that I was, like, denial or something, and then later... I was talking to America Ferrera, who's also in the movie, and she was like, no, I'm denial. So I got a little confused by that.
No, she was shocked, and you were guilt. No one remembered what they
were.
But
it worked out in the end. It worked out in the end. It was a good idea. It was a good idea.
Our panelists discussed the dynamic of real friends portraying real friends on screen, casting It's a Disaster, and shooting the entire film at a single location.
In the, you know, very early stages, when Todd was saying, like, oh, we'll just, you know, get $2,000 and go shoot it in Todd's house over the weekend, we had bold ideas about how we, because originally Todd was going to play the David Cross role, how we were going to stretch as actors. And Jeff was going to play the guy in the band with tattoos, and I was going to play the nerdy guy. And then we got Julie on board, and then we got America and Aaron and Rachel, and we were like, I'll just stick with what we know. We don't need to...
Stay your lane.
Stay in the lane.
Yeah, because Julia kept going, who's playing what parts? And we're like, we're still figuring that out. She's like, really? So you guys don't even know what you're playing yet? We're like, we're still figuring that out. But yeah, we kind of stuck to our strengths in the end, and I think it
we decided a couple days into shooting.
I already knew all these guys from making the shorts, and then when I read the script sold me because it was all on paper, and I knew that I would be in good hands. And I was curious about trying a comedy with people that I'm already comfortable with, you know, and felt free to improvise with and whatever. But I remember Aaron and America Ferrera and Rachel Boston and I, all the girls in the film, went and had our little, like, ladies' dinner before we started shooting, and we were all marveling at how the female characters in it are really, really strong, which is, I think, you know, rare these days. But Todd wrote, like, Todd must clearly like women because he wrote really good parts for women.
So you can audition actresses or you can make offers. And the higher up the food chain an actress is, sometimes you just have to make an offer because maybe they won't come in an audition. I mean, the thing is, you see enough of people's work now, you're like, she's going to be fine. Like, other than meeting the person and making sure they're not crazy, you know, a lot of times you are not auditioning people. You're often just casting them, which is kind of is weird as you do this. You think, oh, it's all about the audition. And not really. You can get a pretty good sense of someone's acting capabilities from just seeing their stuff.
I would say Jeff's audition for the movie wasn't the strongest, but he was available. So yeah.
I will say that this movie in its current iteration would not be possible without Julia Stiles, because
go on,
you came, you know, because I mean it is a big risk. I mean, we'd only done one movie before, and you kind of came on and said, basically Julia said to us, she's like, listen, I have 3 weeks available in the summer. If we can shoot it then. She's like, use my name any way you want to help build this project. And it was our first time working with, you know, that level of talent. And it really does make it, like, so much easier when you have, like, oh, Julia Stiles is involved in this project. Like, people will now read the script. People were actually calling us to be in the movie. Who's it? Jesse Ferguson from...
Modern Family.
Modern Family. He called me and said, I really want to play the part of Shane in the movie. He's like, I just want to let you know the part's really great, da-da-da-da. And, you know, if there's ever a chance I could come in and read for Shane, I said, hey, you know, we're big fans of yours, but the only problem is that that's the part I'm playing. So
I didn't know this.
It's not going to happen.
He would have been great.
And do not tell Todd that you want to be in this movie, because I might be out.
No, but it actually also does come back to the friends working with friends thing, too, because, I mean, it all came down to the script. And then when I signed on, pretty quickly after that, America decided to do it. And then she slipped the script to David Cross, and he was like, yeah, sure, why not? Did come down to a good script, but, you know, I think everybody wants to work with their friends, right?
And I think a lot of actors probably get offered, like, the same kinds of roles over and over. And I think what you'll see when you see the movie is a lot of people kind of, whether they begin that way or turn into something else, are playing characters in the movie that are unlike what you've seen them do before. When I first met with David, David said, because David basically is a normal person in the movie. He's the straight man. And he said, Todd, I never get offered to play. He's like, I get offered Tobias roles. But he's like, I don't get offered like normal human beings. So he was very excited just to do that. So think outside the box. Me, I have a cameo.
It's longer than a cameo.
Actually, this clip is online. I play the next door neighbor. I'm wearing a hazmat suit. I play their next door neighbor who comes over to inform them of something that's going on outside, which you can watch online. Well, it was a combination of everything. I've just come to the realization that I don't want to be an actor really with my life.
Time are you doing that stage reading tomorrow? is that 10 a.m.?
3 o'clock, okay, at the cool State Theater. No, I just enjoy more being behind the camera. I enjoy writing. I enjoy directing. And with this, because I knew, you know, because we had all these great people and I didn't want to fuck it up, I was like, I'm just going to lay back. And it was a pretty, at first I was like, I don't know. But then just the thought of looking into the future and being like, wait, I can just go to set and just focus on directing.
I can just take the small job of directing a feature film. Pretty much just phone it in every day.
Well, I mean, as I learned from the DVD commentary of Kevin Costner's The Postman, when you put yourself in front of the camera, then it's just like another thing you got to worry about, and I didn't feel like worrying about it.
The house that we rented for them, and we didn't tell them until like the first day of shooting, was also the house that Marvin Gaye was murdered in. This is true.
It was really creepy.
Didn't you hear something one day?
Yes, I did. It turns out the guy who owns the house is obsessed with Marvin Gaye and would play I Heard It Through the Grapevine all the time. But I didn't know that, and I walked across the street and I heard It Through the Grapevine playing, and I thought I was batshit crazy. And then I thought you guys were playing a prank on me. It was really scary.
Yeah, we shot the whole movie in one house, and it's an actual couple's house where they live. So we had to be in at 7 a.m. and out by 7 p.m. every day because they would come home from work and want to watch Price is Right or whatever.
But also, it was like everybody was there because they wanted to be there. Nobody was, because we weren't there to be, you know, paying for our kids' college funds. Like, right. Everyone was there because we liked the script. And, that just changes the whole vibe on set.
I met with each actor individually and we talked about their character. And some people had ideas about, hey, what about this or what about that? But everyone would always do it ahead of time because we didn't have very much time to rehearse. So, you know, Erin and I almost like rewrote an entire scene because she was like, I feel like this. And I was like, you're right. And we did it, you know, on the weekend. You'll see when you see the movie that there's a lot of just big group scenes because like we were saying earlier, we wanted them to feel like friends, like real friends who get together. And in real life, friends talk over each other. They interrupt each other. So I told them all, you know, this is, I call it the Entourage syndrome. You know, the HBO show Entourage, when it's like, I say something.
And then I say something funny.
And then I say something to cap it off.
And like, people don't talk like that. People interrupt each other. They talk over each other. So I told everyone when we do these big group dinner scenes, talk over each other, interrupt you. As long as we get what's scripted out in between, people can throw away comments, even if you're not on camera. And at first everyone was like, what? I don't understand. Why are people interrupting me? But I think they got more into and then of course our sound guys were like, what are you telling them to do? But eventually they got the hang of it. And I think when you see the movie, it feels like these people know each other for that reason.
Todd gave us a note about improvising around the dialogue he had written, which it was kind of him to give it to the whole cast, even though I think he was just talking to me. When you memorize lines, it's fluid. And Todd was very clear that changing up the words that I've written in a different order does not constitute improv. So word to all you actors out there, memorize the script before you get to set. It's helpful.
And the other thing is because we did have all these long takes in the movie, there would be a 4 or 5 minute long take and then someone would improv at the very end and ruin the entire shot. I'd be like, no more improving in long takes. Kevin.
Hey guys, the bonus extras on this DVD are just going to blow you away.
Small budget films, going from viral videos to the big screen, distribution, promotion, and the virtues of independent filmmaking.
It was in between the Blair Witch Project and Avatar. You don't ask that. No, and here's why, that no one will ever give you an answer as to what their budget was, because the number we made the movie for is probably not what we told certain other financial institutions what we may have made it for.
I feel like they did a pretty good job offering us the amount of money that reflected what we spent, which was very little. Our distributor, I think, sussed out what our budget was pretty effectively. We actually got distribution through Oscilloscope. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that them, but they are one of the last great art house, I think, DVD slash theatrical brands. I think one of the smartest things that we did early when we were first doing like viral videos is that we had a monthly show, and we told people, like, we're going to show you three new videos at each show. Like, the live show just really became nothing more than an elaborate deadline. Like, when you're writing a spec script or you're doing your viral video or you want to do a Sundance short or whatever, like, it's really hard to, like, force yourself to do it because it's hard work. And, like, and, you know, so by creating deadlines for yourself, I think it's really smart. And, you know, I think sometimes, like, even with a film, like, sometimes you just tell people, we're shooting this film on March 25th of next year. And all of a sudden it becomes a lot more tangible. So sometimes just setting crazy deadlines for yourself, maybe you have to push the shoot or whatever, but so many people like wait for everything to be perfect and then decide to shoot something, and it's never going to really happen that way. The independent film market is so bad right now that it is weirdly like, I think we can make more money off a play than that movie is going to make, and I'm not, because it's true, it's like, there's like, it's rough out there.
All you aspiring filmmakers, pack it in, give up.
Don't do it for money. And sometimes when you have no money, like we did on this movie, it's easy to just tell everyone, can you do this for $100 a day? And everyone's like, you got no money? All right. What I do think that sometimes when you have like $3 or $4 million, like all of a sudden everyone's like, well, I'm not going to work for what I would have, you know, it becomes a little bit of a, every production, the department starts creeping up their budgets and everyone wants more money. And so weirdly, like the project does kind of expand to fit the budget sometimes.
I read an article about how Adam Sandler's Happy Madison Productions is an entity that exists of just he and all of his friends, and they make a movie once a year, whether it's good or not. No, but it's him and all of his buddies from back in the day, and they make a movie once a year that the same people work on, and it's the same people who have been doing it for 10 years, and they have a building on the Sony lot, and they make movies.
We've been very lucky in the fact that both of our movies have been completely just private investors with, you know, no ties. We've gotten distribution for our movies after the fact, so it's like we made the movie on our terms, and this is the cut. And even, you know, the distributors on Scenesters and, you know, this newest one on Oscilloscope, they, you know, they didn't tell us like, yeah, if you guys could really just trim 20 minutes or whatever. So we've been very fortunate to go out and seek out that private money where those people are happy, you know, to be making movies with us, which is we're happy about them giving us money to do it as well. And, you know, there's not a lot of cooks in the kitchen outside of kind of the three of us. So
our panelists close offering advice to independent filmmakers.
You got to hustle. When we came here with the Scenesters in 2009, we were putting up posters, fake crime scene tape. It's about crime scenes. And so we were putting up missing posters, and we were handing out postcards. This year, we're like, fuck that. No, there's ways to promote your premise and the idea, you know, and why people should go see it.
I do think like a big thing that people don't pay a lot of attention to is like, if you're making a movie, think to yourself, is this movie in a genre that makes money? I mean, if maybe your goal is to make money, it's to be your calling card. Like Tiny Furniture for Lena Dunham was a calling card movie. It's not a movie that's ever going to make any money, but you know, she's now doing an HBO series. And I also think like a lot of times people don't ask, like I know, like I think on the Scenesters, we just didn't even think, oh, we're not going to ask anyone like a celebrity to be in this movie, because they wouldn't want to be in our movie. There's a little of that fear sometimes. So I think sometimes you just have to ask, and you have to go through the agencies and stuff like that. But if you have a great script and you could find the right actor where that script serves maybe a missing note in their career, you know, or something challenging for them to play, they might do it. Yeah,
don't be shy about sending it out there to, you know, whoever actor you want, to their people. Because, I mean, even on Scenesters, like Jeff was saying, we're like, we'd like to get someone of, you know, note in this, but, you know, we're kind of nervous about it. And we sent it out, and we got submissions back from, like, Dan Castellaneta? Lynetta? Simpsons
Homer.
Guy. Homer. Like, Morgan Fairchild, and we ended up putting Sherilyn Fenn in the movie, and she was great, and she was awesome, but that's not something we ever have expected to have come back to us, like, oh, they're interested in this part.
And actually, if you're going to spend money on trying to promote your movie at, like, a festival, a PR person is worth their weight in gold, because one review in like the Austin Chronicle, one review or mention in like the festival guide or the festival preview is worth way more than you standing on a corner handing out postcards to random people walking on the street. So we learned that handing out postcards sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. But if you get a PR person to talk to the person at the magazine or the blog or whatever. Like, that is the best right there.
Like, if you're going to like a local festival, like if you're going to the Oxford Mississippi Film Festival, you might want to hire a local publicist there, because they actually know all the local publications. They know all the publicists. I mean, PR is really a relationship business more than anything. So, I mean, a good publicist knows, you know, is chummy and friendly with all the writers. And so PR is the first thing you spend money on.
Today's podcast was produced and edited by Brian Ramos, with additional editing help from Jamal Knox. For more information on the podcast, On Story, the television show, and Austin Film Festival, go to www.onstory.tv or www.austinfilmfestival.com.